content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the July 28th, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. The drawing on the cover this week is the globe, our planet set in the background of space. And all around the edge of the globe are flames kind of whipping. And you can see out in the Atlantic Ocean a huge hurricane. And you can see North and South America, but if you look more closely, it's misshapen a little bit. Like you can't see Florida or the East Coast and parts of South America, I guess, from sea level rise. And the title is Predicting Doom. Can a worst case scenario scare Americans into caring about climate change? And I believe we get to that article with the controversy of the week. But as usual, we will start with the main stories and how they were covered. GOP's repeal and replace bill dies. What happened? Senate Republicans all but abandoned their attempts to overhaul the nation's health care system this week after a last-ditch effort to repeal Obamacare collapsed in disarray, dealing a major blow to President Trump's legislative agenda. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had originally intended to hold a vote on the GOP's health care bill, known as the Better Care Reconciliation Act, but was forced to abandon the legislation after four Republican senators came out against it, leaving him at least two votes short of the necessary 50. McConnell moved to a fallback plan to vote to abolish major parts of the Affordable Care Act in 2 years without an immediate replacement. But that effort also sank when three moderate Republican senators pledged to oppose it, saying it would irresponsibly cause chaos on the insurance exchanges offering individual policies. "I did not come to Washington to hurt people," said Shelley Moore Capito, a Republican from West Virginia, one of the defecting Republicans. McConnell said he would still schedule a procedural vote on the repeal alone plan early next week, though he conceded it was unlikely to pass. "It's pretty obvious we've had difficulty getting 50 votes," McConnell said. Trump said he was disappointed with his party's failure to repeal Obamacare, and at a White House lunch for all 52 Republican senators, he pressed them to pass an even better health care bill before the August recess. "Inaction is not an option," said Trump. If Republicans were unable to revive their repeal and replace legislation, he said, he would let Obamacare fail and blame Democrats for refusing to work with Republicans on a replacement. "I'm not going to own it," he said. McConnell pushed back against this strategy, saying that Republicans might have to work with Democrats to shore up Obamacare's insurance markets, which in some rural states have seen an exodus of insurers and rising premiums. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer called for a joint effort to provide bigger subsidies, lower premiums, and lure back insurers. "The door to bipartisanship is open now," said Schumer. "Republicans only need to walk through it." What the editorial said. The GOP's self-inflicted health care fiasco is one of the great political failures in recent U.S. history, said the Wall Street Journal. Republicans campaigned for years on undoing President Obama's ill-advised signature health care policy. Now they finally have a majority in the House and Senate and a president willing to sign literally any bill that lands on his desk. But in the clutch, they choked. If Republicans can't fulfill their basic promises, why should voters elect them? The GOP's assault on Obamacare is over, at least for now, said the New York Times. But Trump's petulant promise to sabotage the ACA could do great damage to millions of Americans who depend on it. Nearly 40 U.S. counties are already at risk of having no insurers in the marketplaces next year. If the Trump administration carries out its threat to stop providing subsidies to insurers, premiums will surge and a death spiral in those states will begin. The only humane option is for Republicans and Democrats to work together to fix the marketplace. What the columnist said, if Obamacare repeal is dead, blame Trump's malpractice, said Quinn Hillier in the Washington Examiner. The president never came close to learning even the broad details of health care reform, constantly undermined other Republicans, and contradicted himself on what he favored, at one point labeling the House version of the replacement bill mean. Now he is proposing political suicide by insisting the GOP, the party in power, should do nothing as individual insurance markets collapse. Trump has repeatedly broken his core campaign promise, said Philip Bump in the Washington Post. The real estate mogul rode to the White House on a simple pledge. I am a deal maker, promised Trump, and I will make deals. Yet in 6 months, he hasn't secured a single major legislative accomplishment and spent the last crucial week of Senate negotiations celebrating Bastille Day in France and golfing at his New Jersey club. Turns out Trump was just another politician making promises he couldn't keep. The defeat shows that conservatism is in retreat, said Josh Krasher in NationalJournal.com. Republicans never made a strong free market case for Obamacare repeal, arguing, for example, that requiring businesses to offer health insurance stunts growth, or that soaring public spending on health care crowds out necessary resources for other priorities. Instead, Republicans pretended that more people would be covered as a result of the GOP's reforms, which was not true and not the goal of their efforts. They got trapped into playing the opposition's game and lost. The larger lesson of this sorry episode, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com, is that today's Republican Party faces some serious contradictions. Once the arm of the Rotary Club and affluent suburbs, the GOP now relies on the votes of middle-class and working-class voters, many of whom are beneficiaries of federal programs such as Obamacare and Medicaid. But the GOP remains beholden to its richest, most conservative donors who hate being taxed to help pay for public benefits for the poor and middle class. Republicans are torn between interests of small government conservatives and those of their working class base. They are now paying the price. What's next? The GOP's healthcare meltdown is just a hint of what's to come, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. Congressional Republicans face an unusually challenging few months, including looming fights over the debt ceiling and the budget, and they could again find themselves caught in a paralyzing dispute between their conservative and moderate members. That division is already undermining tax reform, said Ramesh Panuru in National Review. Republicans were hoping tax cuts would salvage the party's legislative agenda, yet neither Trump nor Congress has a clear sense of whether to cut individual or corporate taxes or how large those cuts should be. It's a farce. Republicans have total control of the government. Will they ever get anything done? And the controversy of the week, as the cover suggested, climate change. Will doomsday scenarios backfire? However alarmed you are about climate change, said David Wallace Wells in New York Magazine, you are not alarmed enough. After years of attacks from climate skeptics, the scientific community has become overly cautious in its predictions of how climate change may impact life on Earth and how quickly. Behind the climatologist's public reticence, however, there is growing evidence that unless we act now to dramatically cut carbon emissions, by the year 2100, the human race could be living, or rather dying, on an uninhabitable planet. Temperatures are already rising rapidly, particularly in polar regions, and within the next few decades, warmer air could melt the Arctic permafrost, releasing 1.8 trillion tons of trapped carbon, twice as much as is currently in the atmosphere. This chain reaction effect will greatly accelerate the rate of warming, rapidly raising global temperatures by more than 8 degrees. Baking heat and drought will quickly turn most of the planet's agricultural regions into deserts. Seas will rise by as much as 10 feet, inundating coastlines. People all over the world will literally die of 110-degree heat and suffocating humidity. The worst can still be avoided if this scenario shocks us out of our complacency, but right now, we're on a course to destroy our planet. What hysterical nonsense, said Orrin Cass in cityjournal.org. Many climate experts are discrediting Wallace Wells' dire predictions as disconnected from reality. Predictably, however, liberal pundits have heaped praise on the hyperventilating article in their fervent hope that climate catastrophism will help scare the public into supporting intrusive government efforts to restrict carbon emissions. The reality is that alarmism only creates a backlash, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. The public remembers past doomsday predictions about environmental catastrophes that didn't happen because they were either overblown or solved by human ingenuity. So it's all too easy to laugh off a wild-eyed climate change alarmist shouting, "The end is nigh." Climate doomism, in fact, can be just as destructive as climate change denial, said atmospheric scientist Michael Mann in WashingtonPost.com. By painting an overly bleak picture, people like Wallace Wells risk demoralizing the public into fatalistic passivity. If an overcooked Earth is all but inevitable, why should we change our way of life now? Actually, Wallace Wells didn't say the situation was hopeless, said David Roberts in Vox.com. In laying out the worst-case scenario, he said explicitly that the planet could still be saved with prompt and concerted action. The fact is that most people simply have no idea how scary climate change is. The problem, said Robinson Meyer in TheAtlantic.com, is that there are two equally true but conflicting narratives here. On the one hand, our hotter planet is already experiencing more mega droughts, wildfires, and long-lasting heat waves. At the same time, President Trump has pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement. On the other hand, a strategy for addressing climate change is coming together. With the plunging cost of solar and wind energy, the dawn of electric cars, and serious emissions control efforts by most nations. To focus on the first story risks demoralizing the public, while to focus on the second risks sending the message that the problem is well in hand. The truth is that at this point in history, no one knows whether our efforts to head off disaster will be successful. Did Wallace Wells exaggerate the threat to terrify his readers into action? No doubt, but a steadily warming climate is still the worst problem in the world, and terror is appropriate. And it was a good week for revisionist history. after Vladimir Putin disputed historical accounts that the 16th century Tsar Ivan the Terrible murdered his own son, suggesting that the story was concocted to slander Russia. This has been a trend throughout our history, Putin said, because our vastness is feared by everyone. It was a good week for dissenting opinions. After a Washington, D.C. judge overturned the conviction of a political activist who was arrested by Capitol Police for laughing during Attorney General Jeff Sessions' confirmation hearing, the judge said the conviction was disconcerting. And it was a good week for tough love. After Pope Francis hung a sign on the door of his apartment telling visitors to stop complaining and instead take steps to improve your life. The sign warns that violators are subject to a syndrome of always feeling like a victim. But it was a bad week for selfies. After a teenage girl photographing herself amid a row of pillars topped with crowns at a Los Angeles art exhibit, brushed one of the pillars, causing them to fall like dominoes and create $200,000 worth of damage. We trust people, sighed artist Simon Birch. It was also a bad week for silly old memes after Chinese authorities banned Winnie the Pooh from social media because of frequent, unflattering comparisons between the character and roly-poly President Xi Jinping. And finally, it was a bad week for mixed messages after the White House launched Made in America Week to promote domestic products, despite the fact that 100% of Ivanka's fashion goods and many other Trump-branded products are made overseas. Spokesman Sean Spicer said it would be inappropriate to comment on that contradiction. On the briefing page, title this week, Sex, Drugs, and the Summer of Love. 50 years ago this summer, 75,000 young people flocked to San Francisco to turn on, tune in, drop out. How did the Summer of Love begin? In January 1967, San Francisco's nascent hippie community held a gathering of the tribes called the Human Be-In in the city's Golden Gate Park. At least 20,000 people came, many long-haired and wearing outlandish costumes, to protest a new California law banning the drug LSD, which was freely distributed to the crowd. The beatnik poet Allen Ginsberg led a mass Om chant, while the LSD guru Timothy Leary invited the protesters to turn on, tune in, drop out. Music was provided by local psychedelic rock bands, including the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane. It was the first of the year's major happenings, and it generated national publicity. In the spring, a self-appointed hippie council invited the youth of America to San Francisco to experience the magic for themselves during what it called the Summer of Love. How many people came? Starting at spring break, some 75,000 to 100,000 young people converged on the city, inspired by the prospect of a new way of life centered on free love, communal living, and psychedelic drugs. At the epicenter of the counterculture was the down-at-the-heels district of Haight-Ashbury, which had been colonized by a number of alternative communities. Scott McKenzie's ballad, San Francisco, Be Sure to Wear Flowers in Your Hair, A Siren Call to Youth, became an immediate hit on its release in May. Mainstream America watched aghast as TV and newspapers provided daily coverage of the antics of the flower children. The biggest of the summer's mini-gatherings was the Monterey Pop Festival in June, the first major festival of its type, where a crowd 60,000 strong witnessed performances by Jimi Hendrix, Otis Redding, Jefferson Airplane, and another local band, Big Brother and the Holding Company, fronted by Janis Joplin. Why was San Francisco the focal point? Throughout the 1950s and 60s, San Francisco and the Bay Area attracted artists and those looking for a bohemian lifestyle. Beatnik icons, including Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, William Burroughs, and Neil Cassidy, lived and wrote in the city's North Beach neighborhood. Their works, which sowed the seeds of the hippie revolution, expressed contempt for the cultural norms of 1950s America and encouraged spiritual questing, sexual liberation, experimentation with drugs, and a rejection of materialism. There was also a large radical student community in the area based around its various universities and colleges. And who were the hippies? They were essentially an assortment of like-minded tribes based in the Bay Area at the time. Ken Kesey's Merry Pranksters toured in a graffiti-covered school bus driven by Cassidy and offered free acid tests with LSD-laced Kool-Aid and diplomas for those who passed. In Haight-Ashbury, there were groups such as the Family Dog, who lived communally and did much to popularize the fashion for long hair and old-timey clothes, and the Diggers, community anarchists, who sought to create a society free of money. The San Francisco Chronicle columnist Herb Kahn dubbed these young bohemians hippies, a slang term for someone who is hip or in the know. Were the hippies political? To an extent, the period was politically charged. The Vietnam War was raging, and the civil rights movement had given way to inner-city race riots. But among the hippies, political aims were mixed with broader lifestyle protests. Peter Coyote, co-leader of the Diggers, later recalled that he was interested in two things, overthrowing the government and effing. They went together seamlessly. Free love, abetted by the growing availability of the contraceptive pill, was a central tenet. In July 1967, Time magazine attempted to describe the hippie philosophy. Do your own thing, wherever you have to do it, and whenever you want. Drop out, blow the mind of every straight person you can reach. Turn them on, if not to drugs, then to beauty, love, honesty, fun. How did the summer end? By the time the summer influx was in full swing, the city's services were struggling to cope, and the streets were full of teenagers with no money, no food, and no plans. By July, crime and violence were soaring, and there were frequent clashes between the hippies and police. In the fall, most of the young people went back to college or returned home. The summer of love, said Joel Selvin, another Chronicle columnist, was a utopian movement that was undermined by the reality of the human species. Did hippies change the world? In the short term, no, but there's no denying the transformative effect of the summer of love on mainstream society. It left an indelible imprint on popular music, how people dressed and wore their hair, and, more generally, people's perspectives. Hippie enthusiasms have spread out across the Western world, including drug use, sexual openness, blue jeans, environmentalism, yoga and meditation, organic food, and vegetarian diets. What was once the counterculture is now part of the culture. William Hedgepeth, who as a young reporter went undercover to write about the summer's events, explained, "Consciousness is irreversible. I never wore a suit again." We're moving into the columns. We'll take two from the U.S. this week. First, don't repeat past blunders in Iraq. The recapture of Mosul is terrific news, said USA Today. But it's what happens after ISIS is finally evicted from its strongholds in Iraq and Syria that will define whether extremism has won or lost. The battle for Mosul left 80% of the city in rubble and hundreds of thousands of residents stranded in desert displacement camps, broiling in the 110-degree heat. A host of factions will now jockey for control of the region. Sunnis, Shiite militias, Kurds, the Iraqi government. There's even fracturing within tribes and families, especially between Sunni Arabs who shunned ISIS and those who did not. To avert a replay of the chaos and terrorism that followed the U.S. invasion in 2003, the State Department and UN must deploy their soft power to mediate among the rival factions. Free elections should be held in Nineveh province in September, so liberated Iraqis can choose their own local leaders. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi's central government must be pressed to give Sunnis a fair share of power. The U.S. blundered badly in 2003 when it invaded Iraq based on false premises, and again in withdrawing all troops in 2011. Blundering a third time would be unforgivable. A remedy for blind partisanship. In our polarized politics, righteousness comes easily, said David Linhart. Any discussion of the hot-button issues that divide liberals and conservatives easily spirals down into a nasty personal argument. So I have a suggestion. Pick an issue that you find complicated and on which you're legitimately torn or harbor secret doubts. Read up on it. Then do something truly radical. Consider changing your mind, at least partially. If our political system is to become functional again, instead of an intractable war between blindly loyal tribes, Americans need to open their minds, consider evidence and well-reasoned opinions, and be willing to see the gray in issues we now define in black and white. Liberals like me, for example, should be willing to consider the idea that our immigration policy should be more like Canada's, which admits people based on whether they have skills to contribute to the economy. We should also examine whether charter schools can help poor children get a better education. Tax reform, global trade, health care, abortion, the minimum wage, all are complex issues with no simple right answer. By questioning our own beliefs, you may discover new information and increase your respect for other Americans. This is from China. Was Liu Xiaobo a patriot or a patsy? China has earned a grim place in history with its mistreatment of Nobel Peace Prize laureate Liu Xiaobo, said the Globe and Mail in an editorial. The 61-year-old Chinese thinker and dissident died of liver cancer under guard in a hospital last week after authorities refused to let him go abroad for treatment. The only other Nobel Peace Prize laureate to die in custody was imprisoned by Nazi Germany. Liu had spent much of the past three decades in Chinese prisons. He was first detained in 1989 for his part in the pro-democracy Tiananmen Square protests. Liu's final period of imprisonment began in 2008 when he was locked up for his role in writing the Charter 08 Manifesto, which called for such dangerous innovations as free speech, freedom of religion, an independent judiciary, and democratic elections. After Liu was awarded the Nobel in 2010, the government in Beijing blocked Chinese internet users from searching for his name or the word Nobel. The regime remains so afraid of Liu's words, his ideas, and his hope that following his death, it even had his body cremated and his ashes scattered at sea, depriving his supporters of a memorial site. Liu's death is a tragedy for China and the world, said the South China Morning Post. To Beijing, Liu was a threat to one-party rule. Chinese leaders through the centuries have always feared open debate, thinking it leads to disputes and then chaos. Officials in Beijing believe that only they can solve China's many challenges through economic policy. There may be other ways, though, necessitating discussion and debate. Shutting people out by silencing them is no solution. The authorities couldn't shake Liu from his pro-democracy beliefs through years of persecution. His death will not diminish the desire of Chinese for greater participation in politics. Enough with the deification of this convicted criminal, said the Global Times. The Western media has heaped laurels on Liu, likening him to South Africa's Nelson Mandela. In fact, he was a paranoid, naive, and arrogant political agitator who wanted to overthrow China's successful political system. Like others who call themselves dissidents, Liu was a victim led astray by the West. During the decades that he attempted to stir up trouble here, China was making great strides economically, lifting millions out of poverty. Western forces and dissidents like Liu are disruptors of China's steady progress. Both the West and the Chinese authorities have misinterpreted Liu, said Alex Lowe in the South China Morning Post. While foreigners emphasize his support for democracy and human rights, that was only one facet of his deep and complex thinking. He was also a critic of Western capitalism. His beliefs came from his deep knowledge of the full range of Chinese literature and culture, stretching back thousands of years. Liu's reformist impulse and patriotism were deeply Chinese and reflected his devotion to his country and its people. Why Crooks Are Stealing Pistachios is the intriguing title of our in-depth article this week. In California's Central Valley, millions of dollars worth of almonds, walnuts, and pistachios are disappearing without a trace, said journalist Peter Vigneron. Who's behind the heists? At 11:22 a.m. on Thursday, June 20th, 2013, an orange Freightliner tractor trailer arrived at Crane Walnut Shelling in Los Molinos, California. The truck's driver, a man in his mid-30s wearing a gray T-shirt, introduced himself as Alex Hernandez. He said he was from K&G Transport Services, a company contracted to take a load of Crane's walnuts to Bulk Barn Foods Limited, a Canadian food retailer located 2,600 miles away in Ontario. Hernandez had arrived before the pickup had been scheduled, which initially made Crane's logistics director suspicious. But after double-checking the paperwork that he provided, she directed employees to load 630 cartons of walnuts worth $85,000 into Hernandez's trailer. At 12:06, Hernandez left Los Molinos and headed south through California's Central Valley into Glenn County, where he picked up a second batch of walnuts from a processor called Carrier Family Farms. By Monday, June 24th, neither batch of walnuts had arrived in Canada. A representative from the shipping brokerage tried to, but failed to reach K&G, and alerted Crane to the possibility that the nuts had been stolen. On June 27th, Chad Parker, a then 38-year-old agricultural crimes detective with the Tehama County Sheriff's Office, went to investigate. Crane's chief financial officer showed Parker a photograph from June 20th and provided him with the Freightliner's plate number and a photocopy of Hernandez's commercial driver's license. What Parker found made little sense. The plate came back registered to a different model of truck, and the license number belonged to a 30-year-old woman. Later, when Parker pulled records for the phone number Hernandez had listed on the paperwork, he found that it was a prepaid cell phone with a Miami area code. It had been activated for the first time only 2 days before the pickup and then disconnected on June 29th. Tractor trailers do not disappear easily, and Parker considered issuing a be on the lookout for the Freightliner, but more than a week after the theft, he decided it was likely long gone. Petty thefts of walnuts are not uncommon in Central California. Several counties even ban the sale of nuts before harvest is complete to discourage black market sales. But the crane theft, along with similar heists in 2011 and 2012, seemed different to Parker. They were committed by people who appeared to understand the trucking business, identity theft, and computer security. Neither of the earlier crimes had given Parker much to investigate, and at first this one looked no more promising. I'm left holding a report saying, "Someone showed up, and I've got a license plate that doesn't exist," Parker told me last winter. "They disappear into the night." Around the time of the crane theft, Rich Paloma, a police officer turned reporter at the Oakdale Leader, a weekly paper based several hours south of Tehama County, began tracking high-value loads of nuts that had vanished. Paloma counted half a dozen heists, valued at more than $1 million in the previous year. In the fall of 2013, he published an article speculating that the thefts were coordinated. "When you look at the logistics needed to complete this crime," he told me, "all signs point toward an organized group. You steal 375,000 pounds of almonds, you're not going to sell it on the side of the road." In recent years, nut theft has exploded into a statewide problem in California. More than 35 loads worth at least $10 million have gone missing since 2013. The number and style of the thefts, quick and professional, as if the characters from Ocean's 11 had descended on the Central Valley, have drawn the attention of federal organized crime investigators and prompted the creation of a regional task force. Why steal nuts? They're worth an awful lot of money. In 2014, the American Pistachio Growers Association reported industry-wide sales of more than $1.6 billion. The organization recently signed endorsement deals with British cyclist Mark Cavendish, Big Mountain snowboarder Jeremy Jones, and the U.S. water polo teams. California grows the majority of the world's almonds and is the second largest producer of pistachios and walnuts. Many environmentalists blame their cultivation for exacerbating California's drought. Nut trees are thirsty plants. Last spring, I visited the Horizon Nut Company, 3 hours north of L.A., in Tulare County. In November 15th, Horizon lost a load of pistachios worth $450,000. Kirk Squire, Horizon's grower relations manager, said that the theft was embarrassing for the company. "You have to imagine you're handing someone $500,000. The man tasked with finding missing nuts in Tulare County is Sheriff Mike Bordeaux, and in 2015 he faced a growing problem. That year, thieves had stolen 6 shipments valued at $1.6 million from area processors, including Horizon. Recognizing a threat to the county's economy, Bordeaux assigned half a dozen detectives to a new unit, the Nut Theft Task Force. I met most of them at a conference for nut processors in Modesto last year. The men were barrel-chested and serious, wearing jeans, cowboy boots, and blousy white dress shirts. They looked as if the department had just then switched their assignment from baling hay to organized crime." Scott Cornell, who heads the transportation business at Travelers Insurance and works with the company's special cargo theft fraud investigators, told the audience that food and beverages overtook electronics as the most commonly stolen cargo in 2010. We think the bad guys learned that food is a great category, he told me. There's no serial number. You can't locate these things over the internet. The evidence is consumed. In fact, food is the easiest target in an ocean of easy targets. A private investigator and transit company owner from California named Sam Wadhani said that he had tracked cargo thefts of tires, Xboxes, computer equipment earmarked for the military, baby formula, tampons, and iPhones. Inventing a fake trucking company is easy, he said, as is impersonating a legitimate one. The only people in the shipping industry responsible for verifying truckers are brokers who connect customers with trucking companies. Wadhani looked into vetting practices at a major brokerage several years ago and asked the company to describe its process. An employee said, "We asked the trucking company to send documents, we pick them up off the fax, and we file them away. We don't look at them, we don't read them." The closer Chad Parker looked at K&G Transport, the more he grew convinced that the crane theft was linked to a broader conspiracy. Email records for K&G revealed that someone had been accessing the company's account from public computers at libraries and internet cafes around Los Angeles. K&G is based in Miami. Cargo thieves often pose as legitimate companies and bid for shipping contracts on load boards, which are sort of like Craigslist for truckers looking for jobs. A thief hoping to steal almonds might try to find transport jobs in nut-growing regions across the country, especially ones that ask truckers to be well-insured or that leave late in the week to give them a few extra days to get away. The crane pickup, which occurred on a Thursday and was headed to Canada, was a perfect target. Parker's first real break came when he discovered that Hernandez had made an error. Crane employees asked him to submit a thumbprint on June 20, 2013, and he agreed. Parker was shocked when the thumbprint generated a hit in the California Department of Justice database. Hernandez, it emerged, was actually a parolee named Marco Alberto Garcia, and he had recently been detained in the Los Angeles County Jail. Parker subpoenaed cell phone records for Garcia's contacts, many of whom seemed to live and work in L.A. When interviewed, however, Garcia refused to answer any questions, and Parker wasn't optimistic about the case. "It went cold pretty fast," he told me. To help navigate the Los Angeles connections, Parker had sought out Mark Zavala, an LAPD detective who is widely regarded as the state's top cargo theft investigator. I met Zavala at a Starbucks in Van Nuys last year to discuss the crisis. "These people know that the punishment for theft is nothing. There's minimal jail time, usually measured in weeks or months," he told me. "The thieves not only understand this, but they make it complicated by stealing IDs." Zavala put me in touch with a truck driver I'll call Andre, whom he arrested several years ago. I met Andre last summer in Commerce City, Colorado, east of Denver. He is 53 and short and was wearing sandals, a baseball hat, shorts, and a blue button-down shirt open to his belly. Andre is ethnically Armenian and lived in the Republic of Georgia before immigrating in 1995 to the Los Angeles area, where he did occasional work with a small trucking company. In 2011, an accident put Andre's truck out of commission. He needed money and approached a friend in the trucking business for help. The man had easy access to federal motor carrier and Department of Transportation ID numbers. "We're going to put these stickers on your truck because they know this company," he told Andre. The man gave him a fake driver's license and a new truck, and then sent him to collect a load of Budweiser. After Andre delivered the beer successfully, the man had him steal a trailer full of beauty products. Investigators call these schemes fictitious pickups, and they are a variation on the style of theft used in the Crane and Horizon heists. The idea is to convince victims that they are working with legitimate truckers, sometimes by making up a trucking company, sometimes by faking the paperwork of a legitimate business. Zavala happened to catch Andre as the beauty products were being unloaded, and then linked him to a 2011 almond theft in Madera, California, from a processor called Going Nuts. Andre told me he collected the load of almonds from Going Nuts as a subcontract while passing through Northern California on a run back to Los Angeles. He took them to a warehouse in Van Nuys, where two men, one of whom had an Israeli-sounding accent, paid him $600 cash. According to a criminal complaint in the case, the almonds were intended for, once again, nut butter in Noonda, New York, but never arrived. Zavala believes they ended up in Mexico. Andre's lawyer advised him to plead guilty to stealing the almonds. He spent just shy of a month in jail and is now back to work as a driver. It appears that some drivers are genuinely unaware that they are participating in a crime. Kirk Squire at Horizon believes that a gullible driver picked up the company's pistachios, not knowing he was delivering them to criminals. In his experience, he says, it's always been a subcontracted driver who doesn't know what's going on. Keeping drivers in the dark makes it significantly harder for police to trace missing nuts, theft on a need-to-know basis. Andre and I spoke at dusk in the parking lot of a shipping facility in Commerce City. The area was a warren of warehouses, empty lots, and tractor trailers. Andre was likable and friendly, though midway through our conversation he mentioned that he fought with Soviet forces in Afghanistan in the 1980s. This revelation was not intended to be threatening, but it did nothing good for my nerves. After we spoke, Andre said he was scheduled to haul a load of coins from the U.S. Mint in downtown Denver back to L.A., a detail I found astonishing given his prior convictions. Before I left, Andre gestured toward the shipping dock where his truck was parked and explained how easy it would be to execute a theft. No security, no cameras, nobody else, he said. It's simple. You've got a truck. You can change your motor carrier number, DOT number, name, license plate. I asked him if he believed that people who'd hired him were part of a larger group. My opinion, he said, pausing. Yes. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Outside. On the health and science page, the lead article is Giant Iceberg on the Loose. An iceberg roughly the size of Delaware broke away from Antarctica's Larsen C ice shelf, permanently altering the landscape of the Antarctic Peninsula. Reuters.com reports, the iceberg spans roughly 2,200 square miles and weighs more than 1 trillion tons, making it one of the largest ever recorded. Larsen C, the fourth largest ice shelf in Antarctica, is now 12% smaller. The phenomenon, known as calving, was not unexpected. For several years, glaciologists had been monitoring the ice shelf for a growing rift, and the process had accelerated within the past year. In recent weeks, the 120-mile crack, which had been running parallel to the Weddell Sea, turned toward the water and finally broke through the remaining few miles of ice. The iceberg, dubbed A68, was already floating before it calved, so there is no immediate impact on sea levels. Researchers point out, however, that Larsen C holds back the flow of glaciers into the ocean and warn that the event could trigger a chain reaction that would increase the flow of glacial melt, raising sea levels by up to 4 inches. Experts say further study is needed to gauge the extent to which climate change played a role in splitting off the iceberg. But in any case, the future stability of Larsen C is now at risk. In the ensuing months and years, say glaciologist Adrian Luckman, the ice shelf could either gradually regrow or suffer further calving events, which may eventually lead to collapse. And we'll go right over to the talking points page. Young men, video games instead of jobs. Is staging a heist in Grand Theft Auto 5 more interesting to men in their 20s than working an actual job? Asked Sean Higgins in WashingtonExaminer.com. Apparently so, according to a disturbing new report by the National Bureau of Economic Research. The hours worked by men ages 21 to 30 declined 12% between 2000 and 2015, and the report's authors believe about a third of that decline is due to the increasingly immersive world of gaming. Many young men, researchers say, are finding they'd rather be avatars with magical abilities in the imaginary world of EverQuest than take a minimum wage job. Joblessness is usually a reliable predictor of misery, said Tim Harford in the Financial Times, and so is living with relatives, as nearly 70% of young workforce dropouts do. Yet these basement-dwelling video gamers aren't miserable. In fact, the proportion of men under 30 say they're very happy or pretty happy has risen to 89%, even as they turn their backs on reality. Behold the great video game scare of 2017, said James Pethakokas in TheWeek.com. If young men are working less, it's because the 2008 recession wiped out so many low-skilled jobs. In our not-so-great recovery, employers are demanding more education and or experience in new hires, which many young workers lack. Young men are probably turning to gaming because of their joblessness, not the other way around. America faces a massive array of daunting economic challenges, but Final Fantasy and Call of Duty are not among them. Don't be so sure of that, said Peter Sutterman in Reason.com. When I recently played Mass Effect Andromeda, I led a mission to settle a galaxy, while dealing with resource shortages, menacing aliens, and other complex problems. When I succeeded, I earned clear rewards such as points or virtual money. Today's video games are not just vivid and engrossing. They're purpose generators, offering a sort of universal basic income for the soul that many real jobs do not. That's both sad and alarming, said Andrew Egger in WeeklyStandard.com. When a gamer comes to the end of a long day of World of Warcraft, the monsters he's slain, the nations he's defended, they're all fictions. Of what use to society is an achievement that doesn't correspond to any actual reality? Colleges. Why conservatives give them an F. Republicans have become reactionary on so many issues, said Denny Westneat in the Seattle Times. And now the right is coming after college. A new Pew Research Center poll finds that by a stunning 58-36% margin, Republicans and Republican-leaning independents believe colleges and universities have a net negative effect on the country. By contrast, 72% of Democrats and Democratic leaners view college favorably. It's been widely known, at least since the 1960s, the ivory tower leans left. So what suddenly convinced conservatives academia is a threat to society? The echo chamber, that's what. Fox News, Breitbart, and other right-wing outlets relentlessly flog protests and other leftist college outrages, real and invented, and insist that science and the pursuit of knowledge are all part of a conspiracy of liberal elites. Yes, campus protesters often go too far, but that's not reason enough to write off the world's finest university system. Don't blame right-wing media, says Megan McArdle in Bloomberg.com. Blame the angry campus liberals who have protected their safe spaces by threatening conservative speakers like Ann Coulter and Milo Yiannopoulos and staging increasingly raucous protests that eventually turned to violence. For decades, conservative parents tolerated academia's leftist bias, said Joe Simonson in NationalReview.com. The implicit bargain was that their children would be trained for life as productive members of the labor force. But today, academic standards have eroded, and ritzy liberal arts colleges are more like spas. Students indoor rock climb in the morning, enjoy a freshly prepared vegan meal at lunch, pontificate about gender and race in the afternoon, and drink heavily and indulge in soft drugs at night. Even liberals should acknowledge that higher education in America is a mess, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Daily News. It's increasingly difficult to get a job without a diploma, yet prestigious colleges are completely unaffordable, not to mention hard to get into if you don't come from the right zip code or the right parents. In this insular world, students are taught there is only one right way to think. For the sake of the country, we need to make college more accessible to kids from the Rust Belt row houses and southern farms, and to encourage a greater exchange of ideas. Maybe then Americans will stop seeing the system as rigged, and our politics will grow less bitter and angry. And we'll wind up with two quotes today, the first from Nelson Mandela. He says, "Resentment is like drinking poison and hoping it will kill your enemies." And this from James Baldwin. He says, "You think your pain and your heartbreak are unprecedented in the history of the world, but then you read." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.